From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, February 6, 2019. And on this day, Governor Janet Mills today made a major announcement about how her administration's planning to deal with Maine's opioid epidemic. We'll look at the plans. That's ahead in just a moment. Central Maine Power Company and Hydro-Québec are offering a benefit package worth hundreds of millions of dollars to win support of their controversial plan to build a transmission line through western Maine's forests. Fred Bever has our story.
CMP wants to upgrade existing transmission lines and build a new line through 50 miles of Maine's western forests to bring electricity from Hydro-Québec's dam systems to customers in Massachusetts. The $1 billion project has drawn fire from many, but not all, environmental groups, while winning support from some industrial electricity users, as well as unions and the State Chamber of Commerce. Now, CMP and Hydro-Québec are trying to win over more. It floated the offer yesterday to a group of parties in a permit case before the State Public Utilities Commission. Confidential documents from that meeting were shared with Maine Public Radio and other media outlets. The proposal includes a variety of perks aimed at winning over environmental groups. Those include $15 million to subsidize residential heat pump purchases and $15 million for an electric vehicle charging station network and consumer rebates for EV purchases. Another $2.5 million would fund planning studies on decarbonization, meaning reducing carbon dioxide emissions from Maine. One Maine-based regional environmental group, the Acadia Center, now says it can support the project's permit application to the Utilities Commission. Deborah Donovan, a policy analyst at the center, would not talk about the proposal's details, but broadly speaking, she says,
we do advocate for rapid decarbonization using tools like electrifying the transportation and the building heating sector. So to the extent that there's provisions in the settlement that would move those along, then that would be consistent with our priorities for Maine in terms of improving the electric system.
Donovan says Acadia still may not support the project in related permit proceedings that focus more closely on environmental questions. CMP has also proposed spending $200 million to upgrade transmission interconnections to improve access to the grid by renewable energy generators in Maine, such as wind, biomass, or solar. Jeremy Payne, executive director of the Maine Renewable Energy Association, says he is wary of the overall proposal. He also declined to speak to details, saying many of them are still not fleshed out.
And it's a little difficult to assess whether they're bringing this forward because they understand how vulnerable they are and that they may be at a tipping point, if this is because of the change in administration or change in the general attitudes of the general public or the host communities. It's a little difficult to figure it out, but clearly they have seen some signal that has caused them to panic.
A CMP spokesman says the company will not comment, citing confidentiality requirements for the negotiations. And the Conservation Law Foundation, which is cited in the documents as the potential co-manager of the $15 million electric vehicle fund, also declined comment. One environmental group, though, is showing no signs of throwing support to the project. Dylan Voorhees, clean energy director for the Natural Resources Council of Maine, says while it's too early to weigh in definitively,
I would say that there are an awful lot of issues that are unresolved and would be unresolved that are important for this project, for our members, and don't address the fundamental concern that we have with the project, which is it doesn't have a climate benefit because it's not actually new generation of renewable energy, and it has enormous impacts on the landscape across Somerset and Franklin County, from wildlife to recreation.
Barry Hobbins, the state's public advocate, meanwhile, declined comment, but Hobbins made the original demand that CMP provide at least $50 million in rate assistance for low-income customers in Maine. The documents show that CMP's new offer would add another $140 million to that to reduce rates for all Maine customers. One intervener estimates that would reduce rates by about 0.3 cents per kilowatt hour. That would save the average electricity consumer in Maine about $1.50 a month. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And you can see the full array of benefits being proposed on our website, mainepublic.org. In a related story today, the Maine Public Utilities Commission's Consumer Assistance and Safety Division says Central Maine Power must immediately address a number of customer service issues. PUC spokesman Harry Lanfear says the utility has failed to issue bills to thousands of new and existing customers since it implemented its new smart care billing system on November 1, 2017. In addition, the commission says CMP has taken too long to address customer complaints and has not been connecting customers who are behind on payments with the Efficiency Maine Trust Program.
So that the trust can make recommendations on energy efficiency programs that might assist those customers.
The findings are detailed in a letter that also lays out some severe enforcement actions which could be imposed if CMP fails to take action. A Central Maine Power spokesperson says the company has received the letter, takes the issues very seriously, and intends to respond. Maine Governor Janet Mills has signed an executive order aimed at accelerating the state's response to the drug crisis. As Mal Leary reports, Mills says it's just the first step in addressing a major public health problem.
As part of her response, Mills has prepared a financial order to reprogram $1.6 million in state and federal funds to expand access to naloxone, the overdose antidote also known as Narcan, and to train recovery coaches across the state. She says the ongoing crisis warrants a swift response.
The time for action is now. In the past 5 years, at least 1,630 people have died from overdose, more than the population of the towns of Chesterville or Eastport.
Last year, overdose deaths in the state totaled 418. The order uses $1 million in unallocated federal grant funds to train 250 recovery coaches and place 10 more in hospital emergency departments. Recovery coaches help develop a recovery plan for a patient and connect them with needed services. While there are over 500 coaches now statewide, not all hospitals have them or have enough to cover the entire day. Gordon Smith, who Mills named as the Director of Opioid Response last month, says the plan will distribute 35,000 doses of naloxone to hospitals and first responders.
$600,000 of that for the purchasing of Narcan and naloxone is the 35,000 doses is actually from a carryover general fund appropriation.
Both the state and federal funds could have been used by Governor Paul LePage's administration, but were not, because LePage opposed to widespread availability of naloxone. Smith says under the new administration, the federal money will also be used to develop long-term prevention efforts. Mills last month started the long-delayed implementation of the voter-approved Medicaid expansion, an important source of treatment funds. Department of Health and Human Services Commissioner Jean Lambrew says it's too soon to say how Medicaid expansion will affect drug treatment here in Maine.
We've been looking at other states, and we have clear evidence from states that have expanded Medicaid that you do capture a population early to try to prevent some of the problems.
Smith says he expects Medicaid expansion will improve treatment efforts and that continued federal grants will be used for ongoing costs of addressing the crisis. Mills has not indicated whether her proposed two-year state budget will include increased state funds to address the crisis. She does say that she will propose lifting the 24-month cap on medication-assisted treatment for Medicaid recipients that was imposed under LePage, a move that will require legislative action. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
The Maine Board of Dental Practice has dismissed the remaining allegations against a Lewiston dentist who was accused of putting the health and safety of his patients in jeopardy. As Patty White reports, the decision comes after nearly a year after the board cleared Dr. Jen Kippax of 64 allegations filed by 5 patients.
Nearly 100 more allegations from 13 other patients remained against Kippax. Last March, the Maine Board of Dental Practice voted unanimously to send the case to district court. But the board is apparently no longer pursuing that option. It recently issued a letter of guidance to Kippax, stating that it had voted to dismiss the complaints. In its letter, the board says that providers have an obligation to effectively communicate with patients, protect patients from harm, and maintain a sanitary and safe office. The letter will be kept on file for 5 years to be considered if any more complaints arise. Calls to the dental board and Kippax's attorney were not returned by airtime. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Finally today, nearly 2 decades ago, Maine passed a law requiring that Native American history and culture be taught in the hundreds of elementary and high schools across the state. Many schools are still a long way from fulfilling that goal, but as Robbie Feinberg reports, a new initiative in Maine's largest city could help to restore an educational focus on Wabanaki studies.
Bridget Neptune remembers a moment from her high school English class in the early 2000s. The school was in a town neighboring the Passamaquoddy Reservation where she lived. Neptune says she recalls hearing rude comments from classmates, and her teacher, she says, wouldn't allow Passamaquoddy to be spoken in class.
And a lot of those conversations just weren't welcomed, and oftentimes there was a lot of racist remarks to be made. I didn't recognize it as racist then, but certainly as I've matured and have other experiences to reflect on, it was a lot of racist remarks.
Even today, Neptune still sees evidence that Indigenous cultures can often be invisible to many. While volunteering at schools in southern Maine, Neptune says some students were surprised to learn that Native Americans still existed in the state.
They just really were completely shocked when they learned that I was Passamaquoddy and that I had a cell phone and that I did not live in a teepee. So it showed that there really needed to be a systemic change in education.
So when Neptune heard that Portland, where her 2 kids attend school, was planning to create a Wabanaki studies curriculum to develop resources and train teachers across the district, she supported it. After about a year of behind-the-scenes work, the district decided last year to use federal funds to create a new position focused on promoting equity within the district's classrooms, with a particular aim on crafting a Wabanaki studies curriculum district-wide. Fiona Hopper is leading the work.
That we weren't, as a district, going to be able to do real, meaningful equity work if we weren't addressing the racism of our state and the racism of our curriculum and the sort of entrenched invisibility of Native people in our curriculum and in our schools.
Since the beginning of the year, Hopper and other staff have been meeting with tribal leaders to create the basic outline of a curriculum. That's involved finding new resources and adapting existing ones that tribes have already created. Much of the work has been in conjunction with tribal historians, including Donald Soctoma, the director of the Passamaquoddy Tribal Historic Preservation Office.
If I had kids in Portland, I'd want them to know the true story of Maine before it was a state, up to the last ice age, and how people survived on this land. You know, instead of, well, the history started when the ships came. You know, that's pretty much what a lot of schools are doing, and it sort of marginalizes Native American history.
The other big effort is helping teachers learn that history.
Most teachers want to do it, but they don't know anything about Wabanaki history in Maine. They don't know where to look for resources, and they're nervous about doing it wrong, or don't even know, even if they're not nervous, they just don't even know where to begin.
So let's hear you again. Chkui. Chkui. Oh, I'm impressed. You guys got that even before I had to explain it. I like that. That means come this way. Chkui.
This year, much of that work looks like this. At the front of the library inside Portland's Lincoln Middle School, Roger Paul, a Wabanaki language teacher, is leading a training for dozens of Portland teachers. Paul teaches them some words and leads them through a short Wabanaki history lesson. His goal, he tells them, is to correct the persistent myths about Native Americans created by dominant culture, like that Native Americans no longer exist.
So I'm here hopefully to fill those gaps.
The district is leading several other trainings for teachers this year, but their work isn't new. In fact, similar efforts began nearly 20 years ago when Donna Loring, a state representative to the legislature from the Penobscot Nation, sponsored a bill requiring Native American history and culture to be taught in all Maine elementary and secondary schools.
I just saw a need that people needed to know we were here and they needed to know about our history and that we were human too, just like everybody else.
Loring, who is now a senior advisor to Maine Governor Janet Mills, says the law had a big impact initially. Several organizations trained teachers statewide. A commission was formed and substantial resources and curriculum were created and shared. But like many educational initiatives, funding was limited and the commission dissolved after only a few years.
It stopped the progress, stopped it from moving as quickly as it could have gone or as well as it could have gone. It had these really knowledgeable people that were at the core.
Portland officials acknowledge that much of their work is still in the early stages and is expected to take years to reach the hundreds of educators across the district. But Donald Soctoma, with the Passamaquoddy Tribal Historic Preservation Office, hopes that by leading this push in Maine's largest city, it could help revive some of the state's decades-old efforts.
They're laying the groundwork for a wider view of a look at the whole population of the state, not excluding Native Americans.
Soctoma says Portland isn't alone. He says other districts, including some in Washington County, have developed their own curriculum in recent years. He hopes that if districts work together and spread their work, they might eventually help meet the goals of the law that was passed nearly 20 years ago. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Wednesday, February 6, 2019. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team. I'm Nora Flaherty.